nation of Kashmir is not entirely unlike something we could conceive of as the Nakba that nobody noticed. There's an ongoing movement by India to occupy all of Kashmir and fold it into their own national territories at the expense of people who have always lived in Kashmir. And this is problematic. They're being subjected to all manner of abuses and violence, unlawful arrests or unjustified arrests, and even killings, torture, imprisonment, pretty much every horror that we could imagine, without any justification whatsoever. And the world remains silent. So it's only natural that they would see General Soleimani as an inspirational figure, because it was that kind of abuse and injustice and extremism.
General Soleimani has carved a place in the hearts of the people in Kashmir. In a widely reported incident in February 2022, Indian military officers in central Kashmir's Budgam district were forced to publicly apologize after they set ablaze a portrait of the Iranian commander, which triggered massive protests across Kashmir. Army officers were later seen putting a picture featuring General Soleimani and leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on a street to pacify angry protesters. The incident demonstrated strong pro-Iran and pro-Islamic Revolution sentiment in the Muslim-majority region that has been wreaked by decades of conflict.
Iran's top anti-terror commander, who led an inspired fight against the West-backed Takfiri Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria for years, is also deeply loved and revered in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the two countries sharing a border with the Islamic Republic of Iran. General Soleimani's leadership of the Fateh Miun and Zainabiyun resistance brigades from Afghanistan and Pakistan, respectively, proved key to the tilting the balance in the favor of the resistance axis, particularly in Syria. He was always full of praise for the anti-Daesh warriors.
The Fateh Miun Resistance Brigade, comprising mostly Afghan nationals, was formed in 2013. The Zainabiyun Resistance Brigade, whose members are mainly Pakistanis, was formed a year later, both under the auspices of IRGC's Quds Force. Both brigades had men who voluntarily signed up to fight the West Bank terrorists in Syria. General Soleimani's incredible leadership of these groups proved critical in the disgraceful defeat of the Daesh terrorist group and its Western backers. It also made the top Iranian anti-terror commander a household name in both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
The efforts of General Soleimani and the militia brigades in Iraq, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and others like them, I don't think we would have seen as complete a defeat of ISIS and other extremist elements in Iraq or Syria as we have. As matters now stand, they're largely defeated, and it's a matter of arriving at a political resolution of the ongoing situation that leaves both Iraq and Syria in a somewhat difficult situation, in no small part because of the U.S. military presence and the infiltration of other Atlantic world nations in their own domestic affairs, notwithstanding domestic legislatures in Iraq, for example, voting to tell the Americans to take their military and go home.
The Fateh Miun, for example, played a key role in the battles for Palmyra in 2016 and 2017, which proved decisive in the defeat of Daesh. General Soleimani referred to the Fateh Miun as a valuable wealth for the entire Islamic world. He was also full of praise for Zainabiyun fighters and once hailed the celebrated anti-Daesh commander Haj Haidar as one of the best around him. Experts believe the participation of Afghans and Pakistanis in the fight against Daesh in Syria helped further cement their relationship with Iran and the Islamic Revolution.
General Qasem Soleimani considered himself a loyal soldier of the Islamic Revolution and strictly adhere to the ideals of the socio-political movement started by the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, in 1979. This movement sought to challenge the arrogant powers. What mainly appealed to the people in South Asia, including India and Pakistan, was the Islamic Republic's unflinching support for the just struggles of the oppressed against the oppressors in places such as Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and etc. General Soleimani was the face of this resistance.
Among the regions most influenced by the Islamic Revolution is South Asia, home to one quarter of the world's population. Since 1979, people in countries such as India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize the masses against forces that perpetuate injustice and infringe on people's fundamental rights. Today, the biggest rallies to mark the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution or International Quds Day outside Iran are held in places such as Kashmir, Kargil, Karachi, and Lucknow. These places continue to be the citadels of resistance against global arrogance.
Well, certainly General Soleimani and the wider effort of Iran and the Supreme Leader and others is synonymous with the Palestinian resistance and support for the Palestinian resistance and the denunciation of the occupation and its excesses. So as Al Quds Day comes every year, or the anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani comes, it's natural for people who protest in remembrance to associate the image and the personality and the figure and the inspiration of General Soleimani with those causes. And I don't think that will ever change. I think this is a scenario that we only ever see once every few hundred years.
This year also, many rallies and programs have been scheduled in India and Pakistan, in particular Kashmir, to mark the third anniversary of the assassination of these celebrated anti-terror commanders. People would again pour into the streets with posters of General Soleimani and other great martyrs of the resistance axis and burn the symbol of the arrogant powers and the illegitimate Israeli regime. Experts believe these annual events are significant to keep alive the legacy of these heroes and to remind the world of the threat posed by the global hegemonic powers led by the United States, which not only paved the way for the birth and resurgence of Daesh, but also eliminated those who fought the group.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Mike Harris. He's an editor at Veterans Today. Mr. Harris, welcome to the program. Now, this week marks the third martyrdom anniversary of General Soleimani and his comrades, including Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes. How do you see their life and their legacy?
Well, I see General Soleimani primarily as a brilliant strategist. And not only was he a brilliant strategist, but a very, very competent tactician as well. He was very successful on the battlefield, going back to his first command when he was fighting the Iran-Iraq war. He was very good at what he did, and he got better as a function of time. He had the tenacity and the bravery to take on situations that the enemy was not expecting, because the odds would appear to be against him, but he was very, very good at finding the weak spots that the enemies had. And any military man anywhere in the world will recognize the brilliance of the man and how well he was. He was the equivalent of Germany's General Rommel for the Iranians. He was just well-regarded even by the U.S. and greatly feared by the Zionists in Israel.
Now, Mr. Harris, the biggest demonstrations following their assassination in a U.S. strike in Baghdad were reported in places such as India and Pakistan. So what makes these anti-terror commanders so popular there?
Well, what makes them so popular, primarily among the Muslim populations, is the fact that he did not tolerate the terrorist aspect. If you look at ISIL or Daesh and you regard them as Muslims, they're really blasphemers in how they would implement or practice Islam. And Soleimani was true to the religion as he knew it and did not tolerate this. And so Soleimani also had a deeper vision. He understood that ISIL, ISIS, and Daesh were funded by the Zionists of Israel, by the Saudis, and by the U.S. And they were really fighting a proxy war against Syria in there. And Soleimani saw through this and was able to treat the enemy for what they really were, and that was a surrogate army fighting on behalf of the Zionist interest in those three countries of the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia.
Mr. Harris, what about the Himalayan region of Kashmir? General Soleimani is greatly loved and admired by the people there. And could we say, is it because he symbolized resistance against injustice that lies at the heart of the Islamic Revolution?
Let's look at it this way. The many people in the world have come to recognize that the Zionist and the Zionist movement is the enemy of all humanity. I don't care what race or religion you are, Zionism is the enemy of all mankind. And Soleimani saw this, and other people who have been victimized by the Zionist mindset, the Zionist programs around the world, recognize this as well. That alone makes General Soleimani a very popular figure among most of the world's population. Besides the fact, as I mentioned earlier, greatly admired on the battlefield as a brilliant strategist. And you combine those two things, a very devout man, very religious man, you just look at the package of the human being that he was, and there's a lot to admire there by anyone who has a similar perspective. So that is why I feel that General Soleimani was so well regarded and so recommended and admired by many people.
Now, Mr. Harris, in February 2022, an interesting incident was reported from Kashmir when Indian military officers were forced to apologize for desecrating a picture of General Soleimani after massive protests. So what message did this particular incident carry in your view?
Well, anytime an adversary desecrates the picture of a national hero, it tells you how afraid they are of him. And so if the Indian officers were desecrating his picture, they were trying to reduce his stature, reduce the admiration that people had for him. People have to realize that wars are won on more than just with bullets and weapons. Well, wars are won by the hearts and minds of people. So by trying to degrade the image of Soleimani, they were trying to degrade the man and trying to reduce his stature and standing among people who shared viewpoints as he shares. So they're trying to belittle him. So that didn't work. The Indian military officers had to apologize for it. So it was really a psychological operation to diminish him because he was so well regarded. He struck fear into his adversaries everywhere he went. Like I said, he was considered to be the General Rommel, who was for the Germans in World War II, their brilliant commander. George Patton for the U.S. was their most brilliant commander. That's how General Soleimani, his stature is like those men, the really great warriors of the past. He was that well regarded.
Now, the resistance brigades of Fatemiyoun and Zainabiyoun from Afghanistan and Pakistan, respectively, played a key role in the defeat of Daesh in Syria under the leadership of General Soleimani. So, Mr. Harris, how would you describe his leadership of the resistance axis?
Well, the effort in Syria was more than just one man, more than just one group. I myself visited Syria several times during the civil war, 2014, 15, and 16. And the effort, the acts that Daesh and ISIS were committing were so despicable that they united a resistance against themselves because no one wanted to be like them. And then you look at Daesh and ISIS, they're funded by Saudi Arabia, they're funded by Israel, they had funding by the United States. I was in Syria, had the Syrian Arab Army shared with me U.S.-made Patriot, not Patriot, TOW missiles that were made by Raytheon Corporation in Tucson, Arizona. How did Daesh get these things unless someone gave them to them? But you look at these things in just the despicable actions against innocent men, women, and children that Daesh was taking, and it formed a resistance that was easy to unite people behind in order to stop Daesh, in order to stop ISIS. Because, they, like I said, they were just, these were the worst of the worst people who were doing these things. And so Soleimani was able to inspire the people to resist them, and not only resist, but to defeat them soundly and to drive them essentially out of Syria. And so that was really his ability to coalesce people around him of different nationalities, from different places, to expel the poison of ISIS, and to get it out of Syria, because no one wants to have that intervene in anyone's life. I mean, when you watch men, women, and innocent men, women, and children slaughtered the way ISIS was doing it, it's easy to get people to unite and to combine their efforts together in order to destroy. That evil in the world. And Soleimani was the right guy at the right place at the right time, and did a very, very good job of uniting these different forces behind him in that effort to destroy ISIS, which I congratulate him for. And if I go on a little off topic, it was a very despicable thing that Donald Trump ordered with the assassination of General Soleimani. He was brought there on a diplomatic mission, and they violated all the rules of diplomacy in order to get him into Iraq to blow him up. I again look at this as the Zionists who are behind this, both within the U.S. Trump administration as well as the Israeli administrations. And these are the most evil people in the world. They have no honor. They have no shame. And they are to be despised everywhere they go. And we as humanity need to unite to destroy the Zionist entities anywhere in the world they may exist.
There you have it, Mr. Mike Harris, the editor at Veterans Today. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Love to have you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based journalist Lishan Wani in this tweet reported large anti-U.S. protests in Kargil city of Kashmir following the assassination of General Soleimani in a U.S. drone strike in early 2020. Tamer Badami, a UK-based writer and political analyst, tweeted a picture of a truck somewhere in Pakistan with a painting of General Soleimani, which shows his astounding popularity in the country. Journalist and commentator Sayed Zafar Mehdi wrote about massive protests that erupted in Kashmir after an Indian military officer was accused of burning a photo of General Soleimani in February 2022. He was later forced to apologize. Farrakh Ali Abbas, a Lahore-based biotechnologist, shared a Twitter panel in Pakistan on how much General Soleimani is loved in the country and said a proud nation is paying tribute to a proud personality. New Delhi-based journalist Ozair Rezvi, after General Soleimani's martyrdom, tweeted that his admirers had increased exponentially in India, with Google Trends showing a search for the words, "Who was Soleimani?"
And that was our special episode marking the third martyrdom anniversary of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and the impact these anti-terror commanders have created in South Asia. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The West's unilateral sanctions and attacks against different countries around the world have had a boomerang effect on the Western countries themselves. According to reports, supply chain disruptions caused by the war in Ukraine, rising fuel costs, and the impact of heat waves on crop yields have all contributed to increased costs for producing and processing food. Farmers have been unable to boost supply, leading to expectations that costs will remain above the levels before the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Global food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams noted the world's biggest food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders as spiraling prices leave desperate families struggling to afford to eat, Open Democracy revealed. Nestle, Unilever, Associated British Foods, Mondelez, and Archer Daniels Mill and Company, ADM, have raked in £20 billion in profits in the space of a year while all raising average food prices. Four of the five multinationals, which between them own thousands of popular brands such as Twinings, King's Mill, and Cheerios, have all signaled consumers should expect further price rises. Only ADM has not. The firm's profits would be enough to fill £9.8 billion funding gap twice over that is currently facing the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, which aims to provide food for 160 million people facing poverty by the end of the year. The WFP said it costs 44% more for it to buy food than it did in 2020. The bonanza for food corporations comes amid a 40% increase in the number of people in the UK forced to turn to food banks since April, according to Trussell Trust. The charity, which supports food banks nationwide, has warned it can no longer rely on donations to meet rising demand for energy food parcels. Frederic Mousseau, an economist who has worked for international relief agencies, including Oxfam and Action Against Hunger, told Open Democracy, "How can we accept that a handful of corporations record such huge profits while you have billions of people who are already struggling to survive?" Food prices in the UK have increased by an average of 16% in the past year, with the cost of some staples, such as bread and milk, rising by a third. The prices of vegetable oil and pasta have soared by more than 60%, the highest increases among the lowest-cost groceries tracked by the Office of National Statistics. The UK's biggest producer of vegetable oil, Edible Oil Limited, is jointly owned by American grain giant Archer Daniels Midland and Princess, a UK subsidiary of Mitsubishi Corporation. The former has seen its profits rise by 48% this year and paid out the equivalent of £1.5 billion to its shareholders in dividends and share buybacks in the first half of this year alone. The UK's highest-grossing food company, Associated British Foods, ABF, has also paid out £500 million to shareholders. This month, ABF's chief executive, George G. Watson, who will receive £2.2 million in remuneration this year, told investors at the firm's annual results presentation, revenues benefiting from prices increases and operating profit was solid. We've had to recover a huge amount of input costs from customers that don't like giving you price rises. We've done that job really well, but it's not finished. Some food multinationals have claimed they have tried to soften the blow to consumers when passing on costs. Nestlé chief executive Mark Schindler said the company had made a point of acting responsibility with price increases when announcing its half-year results in July. Nestlé reported half-year profits of £4.5 billion, 11% fall from the same period last year. But the firm has paid out £8.5 billion to shareholders in the form of share buybacks this year, while raising prices by up to 7.5% on its products, which include a top-selling baby formula. These corporations are very adept at rhetoric that doesn't have a lot of substance, Philip Howard, a professor at the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, told Open Democracy. They talk about balance, but if there is a choice between increasing their power and doing the right thing, increasing power is going to win every time. That's what the shareholders demand. Unilever, a British Dutch multinational that also produces household cleaning and personal care products, has made £4.3 billion in profits this year, a 4% increase on last year. The company told investors it has raised its prices by 12% to cover increased costs. At the same time, it has paid out £1.3 billion to shareholders. The UK snack firm Mondelez, which owns Cadbury, has reported a 10% rise in profits this year, bringing in £6.9 billion. The company has handed £2.8 billion to shareholders in the form of share buybacks and dividends, while raising its prices by 11% in the last quarter. The shareholders who own these companies expect growth every year and a return on their investment. Maybe that makes sense for companies selling phones or TVs, but food is not a commodity. It's what everyone of people depend on to survive, and these corporations' need for ever-growing profits poses existential questions for humanity, said Musao, who is also a policy director at the Oakland Institute, a U.S. think tank. Supply chain disruptions caused by the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, rising fuel costs, and the impact of heat waves on crop yields have all contributed to increased costs for producing and processing food. But food experts argue excessive commodity speculation rather than shortages remains largely to blame for spiraling costs. A Unilever spokesperson said, in this challenging environment, when we are facing the highest input cost inflation in over a decade, Making price increases is not easy, and we are very mindful of the pressure that consumers are under. We always take a responsible and considered approach to pricing, and there are a number of levers we pull to offset input cost inflation, such as promotions, pack sizes, and ingredient changes. A Nestlé spokesperson told Open Democracy, "We are absorbing cost to tune of billions of dollars as reflected in the notable decline of gross profit margin. We have been doing everything we can to find cost-saving measures, for example, cutting marketing expenses and finding new efficiencies in production and distribution. Our priority remains to ensure that consumers have affordable access to the products and brands they know and love while still paying fair prices to our suppliers, including farmers and small companies for their sustainably produced raw materials." The spokesperson of ABF, which reported £399 million profits from its grocery division for the year ending September 30, a 3% decrease on the previous year, said, "We strive to make our food as affordable as possible. Like a lot of businesses, we are encountering extreme inflation and increased energy prices. Last year, ABF had to absorb inflation of £1 billion, and the group will have to absorb the same amount in the current year. As a result, we have unfortunately had no choice but to increase prices to retailers, and despite this, the margin in our grocery business is clearly down. Businesses have no choice but to pass costs on where they can, give the scale of the inflation. As we sell to retailers, we do not set the chef price for goods, the retailers do." Mondelez and ADM did not respond to a request for comment. Financial Times noted, "Climate change and the war in Ukraine are set to keep food prices at far higher levels than before the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite signs of moderation in global commodity markets, economists and agriculture experts have warned wholesale food prices have stabilized over recent months, raising hopes that the surge in retail cost of staples such as rice, bread and milk seen in the past 2 years would diminish in 2023. The latest update of Food Price Index of internationally traded agricultural commodities, compiled by the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, published recently, posted its 8th consecutive monthly decline in November since peaking in March. The November index showed prices were just 0.3% higher than a year earlier. However, the stabilization in international markets is yet to translate into lower inflation for households around the world. Even if this does happen over time, costs are likely to remain higher above pre-pandemic levels as the war and weather events limit producers' ability to take advantage of higher prices by increasing supply." Carlos Mera, senior analyst at Rabobank, said, "Normally, the cure for high prices is high prices. We do see weakness in demand, but production has not been very elastic. After several years of bumper crops, thanks to favorable weather conditions, grain prices firmed during the pandemic because of hoarding by consumers, companies, and governments. Even before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which caused prices to spike because of the importance of both countries in producing commodities such as wheat, persistent droughts in key growing regions had pushed prices higher. Both the Ukraine conflict, which has raised the cost of fossil fuels and energy-intensive fertilizer production, and the third year of the La Nina weather phenomenon, the cause of severe droughts in the U.S., Argentina, and Europe, have hit farmers, curbing their ability to increase output. The supply response has been slow. Farmers around the world are applying less fertilizer, and in places such as Africa, this will lead to lower production," said Joseph Schmidhaber, Deputy Director of Trade and Markets at FAO. which expected grain production to be lower next year than in previous years. The FAO is also concerned that there could be a global rice shortage next year if producers fail to find enough fertilizer. Catherine Neese, Chief European Economist for PGIM Fixed Income, a fund manager, said lower wholesale prices would not feed through into retail costs quickly as food production was very energy intensive, with the impact of higher oil and gas prices resulting from Russia-Ukraine conflict lingering. Consumers in emerging markets and developing economies, who typically spend a relatively large proportion of their income on food, are particularly exposed. Many countries in Africa and the West Asia region are reliant on the Black Sea region for imports and tend to have weaker and more volatile currencies. Most global food commodity transactions are priced in dollars, potentially amplifying the effect of higher costs on domestic food prices. Although the extension in November of the Black Sea grain deal between Russia and Ukraine, which ensures at least some of the country's food commodities reach international customers, has lowered the risk of further price spikes, geopolitical conditions remain precarious. Meanwhile, measures used by economists and traders to assess the availability of commodities, such as the stock-to-use ratio, indicate supplies of wheat at the lowest level in more than a decade. Glauber said, "I don't think we are out of the woods yet." Prefeet agreed. It said, "It remains uncertain how the combination of harvest disruptions, energy prices, and monetary policy will play out. However, things could get worse before they get better."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes you meet with people, the most unexpected personalities in the most unexpected times. Now, how to behave with them and what impact they have with you on your life, on your personality? Professor Nakavi is going to help us to understand the relationship with others, especially when it comes to adolescence. Professor Nakavi, when it comes to adolescents, they are very, very eager. They have arousing staff feelings. They're excited. How do they control this relationship with others?
So, as we have been saying all the time, that the relationship with others has to be developed under the umbrella of the relationship with Allah Almighty. And then after that, the most important thing which is there, which the Holy Quran is stressing upon all the time, is bil walidaini ihsana.
Yes.
Wa bil walidaini ihsana. So we need our children to understand how they are supposed to carry out good deeds with respect to their parents. Ihsan does not mean doing them a favor. Ihsan means to be able to deal with them properly in the best possible way, giving them, pleasing them, and pleasing their Lord Allah Almighty. So the most important, if we are able to develop that relationship with our parents at a very tender age, and especially when this sensitive age comes, where we try to become a bit independent, here is the real trial and the test of not only the child but of the parents.
Yeah.
Because it is the parents who are going to teach their children how to behave properly with themselves. If we want our children to behave well with us and treat us well, with kindness, with love, with respect, we need to teach them by example and treat them in a similar way. Mm-hmm. So they are learn to do so with us.
So this is reciprocal, basically.
Exactly. I mean, we as educators, as parents, need to teach them to respect us.
Yeah.
So we cannot expect them to respect us and develop
without just teaching them.
Without being able to create that environment in which they can respect and love and kindness.
And especially when you are disrespecting them.
You can't expect them to respect you if you're not respecting them and teaching them to pay respect.
Yeah.
And of course, again, what is again very important is that respect to parents is not at the cost of respect to Allah Almighty. That is important. The parents should be very sensitive about this issue, that they should not be asking their children to do things which causes the respect of their Lord Allah Almighty. The moment the child feels that he is being asked by his parents to do something which is not allowed in Islam and is going to displease Allah Almighty, that is the beginning of the end. So we need to make sure that what we expect from our child,
we are giving it.
We are giving it. And what we expect from him is not something which is going to severe his relationship with Allah Almighty.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, nowadays you find, as we mentioned the other day also, that elderly women won't want our children to pray, for example, it's too early for you to pray, or to observe the hijab. You'll do so when you get old.
Yeah.
So now you are making them do things which are not allowed by Allah Almighty.
Yeah. So we'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Nakawi. Well, Carol Kugley says, the basis of social relationship is reciprocity. If you cooperate with others, others will cooperate with you. Professor Nakawi, we are discussing relationship with others, and the first relationship was with the parents. Parents, you said that in case they want themselves to get respected, they should no way disrespect a child.
Exactly. So they have to teach them how to respect themselves and how to behave with others, especially starting with their siblings.
Yeah.
That is very important. The relationship between the siblings,
okay,
and their parents should be very, very, as you said, based on reciprocity. But it should be very relationship of love, trust, and they should be the ecosystem which is developed in the family. It should be of a very of love, of respect, of honor. Most of the times we think that this is our own child, we can do anything to him, we can talk, pay respect. You see the example of our Holy Prophet. He did not only stand up for Bibi Fatima az-Zahra salamu alayha just to show that she is a very respectable lady and she's the lady of the heavens. No, because he also wanted to teach us that she is my daughter, and I respect and love my daughter.
Especially in the times of that Arab society, which was very, very ignorant, and they used to burn daughters alive. He showed the importance of daughters this way.
Exactly. Or when, for example, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein would be prostrating in prayers and would carry out the sajda, these small young imams would climb upon his back, and he would not come. He would remain in that position.
He would perform sujood for long hours,
until
a child.
Exactly. So that was not only just saying that. Look, I want to show you that how important personalities they are. No, he was also showing us how to deal with our children. Nowadays, when we want to pray, we say, take the children away.
I'm not getting that bond with Allah subhanahu
wa ta'ala. I mean, children should be kept away. Oh, don't take them into the mosque. They will make
noise.
Noise. No. But in that way, we are...
We have seen even Prophet, peace be upon him, putting Imam Hussein alayhi salam on his back and reciting subhanallah.
He was extending the sajda just...
So that the child gets tired himself and he himself gets down.
Exactly. So these are lessons given to us by the Prophet, Holy Prophet, for everyday lives.
And it's also one of the metaphor. If you look at it in a metaphoric way, like if your child is on your back and you're performing sujood along with your child, it's actually two people getting into the sujood at the same time.
I mean, you are shooing him away. You're calling him to prayers. You are saying that this is something which you should be also doing. You should not run away from it tomorrow. But the time we start scolding our children, don't scream, oh, your father is reciting prayers, remain quiet. Or a child comes and takes up the turba which you're praying upon.
Yeah.
So you keep it in your hands.
Okay.
No need to...
You can use different ways, but you can't just tell your children to go away.
So if we want our children to become attached to Allah Almighty...
Not to detach them, Inshallah, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned for us.
Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakawi, and we're saying, if your children are there while you're praying, your attention is not, attention in prayers might not be much, much important, as important it is to attach your children towards the prayers, rather than ignoring them, rather than locking your room while you're praying, rather than taking them away from the mosques and avoiding them from the state while you're prostrating or while you're with your Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Professor is saying, engage them.
Yes. So we were talking about the relationship with others. So again, we come back to the relationship with our Lord, Allah Almighty, because that is the supreme relationship which has to be there all the time. So we need to develop the teenagers' relationship with their siblings, the elder ones, the younger ones, especially the teenagers, whether if they, you have boys and girls, both at children, both of, and both of them at a similar adolescent age of adolescence, again, that is a very critical stage.
Yeah.
You need to manage that also.
So you said that number one is that a child, a teenager, has to be respecting his parents and his siblings, because you can simply teach them that respect is one of the greatest expressions of love. So if you love us, you should show this expression in the form of respect.
One of the ways of showing that respect is to be a good listener.
Wow.
The problem is now when we talk to our children or our children talk to us, they ask a question and we can't answer.
We act like police.
Exactly. So we need to be patient. We need to say, oh, sorry, I don't know the answer. Let me think. Let me study about it, read about it, and I'll come back to you. Don't be shy about expressing your ignorance instead of, as you said, bullying them. And on the other hand, if they want to express their own feelings, their own understanding, even if it's wrong, listen to them. Be good listeners. Don't
cut
them off.
At least see what's within them.
Exactly. Allow them to feel the comfort of confiding in you. And they know that they can speak their heart in front of you.
We
and
we'll
not tell them off.
Yeah, we know that listening to a child is very important. But how important is it, Professor, when it comes to a teenager?
That is, it becomes more important. I mean, if you want him or her to confide in you, even if he is got involved in something wrong, even something bad, something evil, if he is not able to confide in you and he cannot seek your help, then he will be running away after people who will take him to the wrong, worse
direction.
In a worse situation.
Yeah.
So if he is able to confide in you and you can be a friend for him at that age, he or she would be, even if he or she falls into a trap, into something problematic, you can resolve and you can solve it instead of becoming angry. You
All
should
right.
be very, you, the worst thing can happen, unfortunately. But if you lose your mind and if you become emotional, then you...
And aggressive as well.
So. Aggressive, then you lose the game. You lose the battle. So you need to be very cool-headed. You need to be very patient, very a good listener, and teach him or her to be a good listener.
Yeah, and even because there are some parents, when they get to know about some evil activities of their adolescents especially, they stop talking to them, the first thing. So the first thing, they are creating a barrier between them and their children, and then you say that they can actually get involved in some other people. And maybe they can...
They will certainly then go to people who are outside the family.
Yeah.
They will...
And you never know which direction they are going to
exactly.
take them. Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. Inshallah, in upcoming sessions, we'll discuss more about these topics, how to deal with adolescents. So stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.